And then I got into the whole technology side. That was a whole different world, right? Moving from a bank where you're actually working cases to technology. And that's where I've been ever since. You don't have to be a technology coder to work in fraud technologies.
You're listening to Frank McKenna, a fraud technology expert and the chief fraud strategist for Point Predictive. Welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Not only was there fraud, but there was a lot of fraud. We took a look around and said, where's the fraud now? We solved it for mortgage. Where is it now? And we saw the same thing happening that was happening in mortgage in auto.
In this episode, we discuss how fraud technology is changing the landscape in finding fraud, why the passion for chasing fraud is key to hiring, and how preventing fraud requires creative thinking. He has 30 years of anti-fraud experience. He is a chief fraud strategist at Point Predictive, and he's the author of the blog frankonfraud.com. Frank McKenna, welcome to the Fraud Fighter Podcast.
Robert, it's great to be here. Love the podcast and really looking forward to our conversation about fraud, my favorite subject.
How did you get into the anti-fraud business?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I never had a plan to be in the anti-fraud business. I think like probably everybody else, it was a stroke of luck. It was 1990. I was recently out of college. I was looking for a job, and I was going to every place I could find just applying for a job. And one place, it was called First Deposit Bank. It was a small credit card bank, was hiring for customer service. And I took the job. It was my worst job I've ever had in my life. I had to get up at 5 a.m. and answer phone calls. But one day I got a call from somebody that was pretending to be the customer. It was obviously a younger man calling, saying that he was calling in on the account of an older woman. Immediately my radar went up and I was like, this sounds like somebody's trying to impersonate the cardholder. I raised my hand and my supervisor came over and says, transfer that call to the fraud department. And immediately my ears perked up and said, that sounds like a pretty cool thing, a fraud department. And I transferred it to the fraud department and I became good friends with the people in the fraud department. And one day they told me there was a job to be a fraud analyst, which would be just looking at credit card transactions and calling customers when we suspected fraud. I got that job 30 years ago, and that was the start of my career. Just a stroke of luck. I haven't looked back. I've loved every minute of it, but that was how I got my start. It was just a stroke of luck.
So what is your background? Did you get a degree in business?
I do have a degree. I went to St. Mary's College, so I got my Bachelor of Arts in Liberal Arts. And what that degree was intended for was for teachers. I really wanted to be a teacher. So I got that degree because it's kind of all the subjects combined. I'd never got a degree in business or computers or anything like that. It was really, I wanted to teach. When I got the job, I found that I really gravitated towards the kind of teaching aspects of fraud, you know, training people how to find fraud, educating people what fraud is. And I think that's why my love of teaching kind of transferred well, and that degree really transferred pretty well over to fraud. I did get my MBA after a few years in computer science because I wanted to augment my kind of liberal arts degree with something more technical. And that certainly helped me. Getting an MBA was really a boost in my career, especially in fraud, because you need a little bit of technical background, and that helped me.
You get this job at the bank, and you didn't get into the fraud department, kind of like you kind of slid into it. What did you do afterwards? Walk me through your career.
Yeah, my career, it was interesting. When I got into fraud, I loved it so much that I knew that this was going to be my career. My thought process was I would look around me and say, whose job in this room do I want to be my next job? So what it turned out is I was a fraud analyst and I sat near the fraud investigators. And my job was to kind of proactively reach customers when we thought there was fraud. But I saw the fraud investigators who worked next to me who would actually be the people that investigated the claim when fraud did happen. They would investigate it and try to figure out who did the fraud, try to get the money back for the bank, work with law enforcement, and really deep dive into those cases and do more forensic review. I applied for a job as a fraud investigator, and I got it. And I loved it. And I worked on fraud investigations for about 3 years. One day I saw a guy, his name was Ofer Yitzhaki, and he was in charge of writing fraud rules and technology. So he was in charge of developing the strategies that the bank would use, like the rules in the system that would detect when fraud occurred. So, for example, we would block an account if we saw more than 20 transactions a day on a credit card. We would do things like that. And that job was called a fraud strategy analyst. And I wanted his job really bad. And I applied for it when he left the bank, and I got it. So then I became a fraud strategy analyst. And from there, I got to really get involved in all different types of fraud. And that was about 4 years I was doing that. And then I started to look outside the bank, and I saw that there was a similar job at a big bank called Wells Fargo to do the same thing, but on a really much bigger scale. I applied for that job and I got it. And then ended up handling all the debit and credit card fraud strategies for Wells Fargo. From there, I started to see that there were all these fraud technology vendors that were the banks. We were using some of their technologies like Falcon, which was like an AI solution. And I started to say, maybe I can transition from a bank world to a technology vendor and broaden my career even more. And that's really when I switched from banking to technology, was back in 1997 when I went to HNC Software here in San Diego. And then I got into the whole technology side. That was a whole different world, right? Moving from a bank where you're actually working cases to technology. And that's where I've been ever since.
In the technology side, were you like a coder, or just would you give your ideas to someone? Because someone has to put it into ones and zeros to put it in the computer system. How did you get into the technology side?
You don't have to be a technology coder to work in fraud technologies. There are a lot of people that can do that. My expertise was not in coding. I can't write one iota of code. I have no idea how to do it, but I work on the business side. So what I do is I work with the customers, and then I work with our coders to translate what the customers need the technology to do into the code, into the models, into the user interfaces. So my expertise is really in understanding what the problem is and then help translate that into usable code that we then deploy. So there's a lot of opportunity to get into fraud technology, even though you can't write any code. And kind of, I'm an example of that.
Later on, you start Point Predictive, or you're a co-founder. How did that work out?
I've actually established two companies. So this is a great thing about fraud too. If you have an idea in fraud, and you have a really good idea, and you have somebody that supports you, you can actually create your own fraud company, which is exactly what me and a partner did back in 2004. We had an idea to help mortgage lenders stop fraud back in 2004. So we broke off.
And that was right before the big meltdown, correct?
That was right before the big meltdown.
Yeah, Wild West days.
Wild, Wild West. You are exactly right. And everybody was, when we started the company, they were like, well, why are you going into mortgage fraud? There's no mortgage fraud. And we were like, well, we think there is, you know. And so we started a company in 2004, and we really didn't know exactly what we were going to do. We just wanted to solve the problem. So we actually started to go to mortgage lenders, and you know, this is 2004, and the mortgage lenders actually felt the same way the rest of the industry did, or the other kind of naysayers. They were like, we don't have fraud. And we said, well, we're experienced in looking at data and forensics and analysis. Give us all your data for a couple of years. We're going to scan the data with our technology and with our modelers and our scientists. And we're going to tell you if you have fraud or not. And what we found when we did those first tests back in 2004 was that not only was there fraud, but there was a lot of fraud. The data was telling us that there was probably 1 to 5% of applications had fraud on them. So that company, eventually, we created a mortgage fraud technology. It just went off the chart. We were just selling that technology to everybody, because that's when, you know, 2006, 2007, people started to recognize the problem. We sold this technology to them. And then eventually we sold that company to CoreLogic. And if you know CoreLogic, they're the biggest mortgage analytics firm probably in the world. And so they bought that technology so they could send it, give it to all their lenders. The current company, Point Predictive, me and the same partner, Tim Grace, in 2013, we took a look around and said, where's the fraud now? We solved it for mortgage. Where is it now? And we saw the same thing happening that was happening in mortgage in auto. And we said, let's solve the auto lending fraud problem. And that's how we started Point Predictive.
So what is Point Predictive now?
We are an AI and machine learning company. So that's artificial intelligence, meaning we use a very specific type of technology that learns fraud patterns. We also have our own data consortium. So we have about anywhere in any given month between 2 and 10 million auto loan applications will come to Point Predictive for us to scan and look for fraud. And we are kind of one of the standards of fraud technology for auto lenders to use to prevent fraud. We also do a little work in mortgage and fintech as well. So, you know, like working with the big online lenders. We're all about helping lenders stop fraud using our artificial intelligence and data.
Without going into proprietary information, in general, how does the auto lending business benefit from Point Predictive? What data points are you looking at in particular, without giving away secrets?
We talk about our data a lot, so there's no secrets. We collect about 85 fields of information on every auto loan application: who the borrower is, what type of car they're buying, the dealership, the employment, the income. If you put it on an auto application when you're at a dealership, we get it. Since we get all that data coming from all the different lenders, we can start to spot patterns of fraud in that data. For example, if we see a synthetic identity, which is like a fake identity, come into one lender and they catch it. If we see that same synthetic identity go into another dealership and another lender the next day, we can spot it and we flag it for that lender. We track the network activity. So we're seeing all the activity across lenders. So since lenders work alone, they don't know what happened before they got that loan, what happened the prior day, the prior week, the prior month. That's where we step in, as we find all those patterns on the prior activity we've seen from those borrowers and those dealers.
Interesting. Okay. That makes perfect sense to me, because banks are very decentralized. Yeah, one bank does not know what the other bank's doing.
That's why consortiums are so powerful for fraud, is because they're exactly what the fraudsters don't want you to do. They love when banks don't communicate with each other. They love when people try to work alone, because they get to do the same scheme, the same trick over and over again without any consequences. Consortiums remove all that because it exposes that pattern to everybody. It's like when you go get a vaccine. When you get a vaccine, you're inoculated against that disease or that infection, even though you never had it. The consortium is the same concept, right? We are basically, since we have all the data, we're protecting the lenders before they ever have to experience that fraud.
But in this situation, you get hired to what I call squeeze the balloon. If it goes one place, it goes to another, and then there's got to be a new trend, and you got to be up on your toes to find that new trend to help your clients out.
Absolutely right. I think you're spot on, Robert. It's, you never really get rid of fraud.
No, you're just moving from one bank to another. or one software company to another. How's that?
Right. Yeah, one software company. Or in our case, one industry to another, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You push it out of auto and it's going to go somewhere else. Auto lenders are happy, but somebody else isn't.
I completely agree. Completely agree. With your interest in fraud and your teaching background or love for teaching, why, I guess the question was, I see that Frank on Fraud is really it's sort of like a summary of what's going on in the fraud world. Is that your way to scratch that itch?
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, if I think about, I started Frank on Fraud in 2016. I was working for a bank as a consultant. They were asking me to write white papers, which I love to write, but I would write the white paper and then it would go through an internal review and it would take 4 to 6 months, and a lot of people would review it. And what I wrote, you know, in January would never even get published until like September. And by that time, I'd already moved on. And so Frank on Fraud was really, I was like, why can't I just put a website up? I like to express my views on fraud. I like to report on events. I like to report on operations and people. It was really just about, I think, educating the industry, but also helping me learn and grow myself, because now what I do every morning and every weekend is I wake up and I go to, you know, 7 or 8 different websites that I track. I get information, and if it appeals to me, I write about it. And so every time I write an article, I learn a little bit more. I learn about a new fraud type. I learn about somebody new. Myself, it just, I think it improves my fraud knowledge. That's why I created Frank on Fraud. And it's why, like you said, it's kind of an itch, something that I feel like I almost compelled to do.
And later on, you are joining forces with other organizations, especially nonprofit organizations. I know one of them is called The Noble, which deals with vulnerable populations, financial institutions, and educating them about how to identify human trafficking and elder abuse and that type of thing. How are your skill sets being used for that?
I'm just with The Noble. I know Ian Mitchell now for 10 years, who's the founder of The Noble. Very inspirational. He's one of the key leaders in fraud in the world. And he has a different view on fraud that isn't traditional. What he thinks is, we've got all these fraud fighters across the world and all these people working in law enforcement and people working in the government. Everybody's trying to solve the same thing, which is they're trying to avoid fraud. But what happens with a lot of fraud fighters, myself included, is you end up working for a company and you're trying to help that company's financial incentives. If you work for a bank, you got to protect the bank's money. If you work for, you know, technology company, you have to make that technology company grow. So you can't really focus on the greater good, which is helping the end victim. And The Noble is all about that. It's using your skills as a fraud fighter. It's a human rights organization. So you're basically using your skills to help the victim without any regard for the financial incentive. You're doing it on your own time, right? People are doing it nights and weekends because they're typically employed. So that's what I do. I work with Ian nights and weekends when I can. My role is I really focus on scams. So with The Noble, I head up a working group called the Scams Working Group. It's a collective of people like us, right, that are fraud fighters that, you know, they work at a bank or in the government or they have their own practice, but they get together and we get together and we talk about how do we help victims of scams. And what we do is we create educational pieces around scams. We are creating a data initiative around, you know, sharing data on scam victims. What's amazing to me about The Noble is how many people want to be a part of that. Fraud fighters that have such a passion, they want to do this and they'll do it on their free time and donate their time, money, and resources to fight fraud for the greater good of the victim.
Knowing what you know now, you've got like almost 30 years or at least 30 years experience in the anti-fraud world, going from the very low level of call center all the way up to having your own firm and analyzing data and helping banks out in general, particularly for car loans. If someone wanted to get into the anti-fraud or anti-money laundering industry, what would be your recommendations? You sort of had you didn't really have a straight path and you had a degree in liberal arts and later on got an MBA, but what would be your recommendation today for someone who wanted to get into this industry?
It's a really good question. And you know what? I get emails, Robert, quite a bit from people that are asking me the same thing you just asked me. And they'll just send me an email because they read a blog. The number one thing is, if you really want to get into fraud, you absolutely can. You might have to take a path that a lot of us took, which is you're going to have to get into a job that's going to lead to fraud, a job in anti-fraud. So if you really want to get into fraud, the first thing I would probably do is go and search for jobs in your area that have the words fraud, fraud analyst, fraud investigator. And you'd be surprised at just how many positions there are in kind of entry level, I would say, entry level positions with technology companies, with banks, with insurance companies, for people that want to get a start in fraud. They don't pay much, right? Because they're entry level. But just know that you're going to have to take that foot in the door, take that position that might not be paying as much as you get today, but you're going to love it and you're going to progress. So my first recommendation is just go out there and see what's available and start applying. Now, when you apply, if you have any experience or passion for fraud, make sure you put some of that in your resume. Because if you're going to apply for an entry-level position, they're going to be looking for keywords like fraud or analysis or, you know, even the skills. You can use Excel and some of the technical things. But make sure you have something that's going to appeal to them. And then in your mission, if you have an objective on your resume, make sure you put something about your passion for helping people and stopping fraud and whatever that is that compels you, because that they will see that. That's what I look for when I look for in a resume. So go out there, explore, start applying for jobs. The other thing is there's some you know, organizations like the ACFE, where they'll give you credentials and certifications. That looks really good on a resume, and it's actually a very good training program. It's an excellent organization. It connects you with other fraud people. So organizations like the ACFE, that would be my second recommendation. The third would be, if you're in a bank, if you're in a company, search for opportunities that are in the fraud department. They're very, very willing to take people from one area to another and train them up. So if you're in your own organization, look for those opportunities. And then I would say volunteer as much as you can with everything you can. Right? The Noble, if you really want to end fraud, you can actually join the Noble, and you're going to be connected with hundreds of other fraud professionals who may have opportunities that appeal to you. And you're going to learn from them, and you're going to participate in conversations, and there's a lot that you would get out of it.
In your experience, once you get to a certain level of your anti-fraud career, to go from one level to another or from one institution to another, is it really necessary to have those relationships where people say, hey, I know this guy, he's been at that conference for 5 years, I've eaten lunch with him, he's a good guy? Is it like that, or do you have to still put in your resume and be one out of 1,000 in order to be looked at? Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. Absolutely. If you are recommended to an organization and you're recommended to the fraud, let's say the fraud manager, the fraud supervisor, the executive, if somebody that they know sends your resume to them and says, this is a good guy, this guy knows fraud, this guy is going to work hard, that gives you a leg up, hands down, over people that are not getting that introduction. Number one way, that connection, that network is going to help you. But it's not absolutely necessary. You can really stand out, you know, even if you're one of 1,000, you can really stand out in an interview process by demonstrating your passion for fraud. When I interview somebody, and I hire a lot of fraud analysts, the number one thing I'm looking for is their love of fighting fraud. I know if somebody loves fighting fraud, that they're going to be amazing, because they're not going to treat it like a job. They're going to treat it like their life's work. You can always stand out, but the networking effect is absolutely, I think, a big part of it.
Are there any resources or training that have helped you on your journey that you can share with others?
You know, that's a really good question. So I think through the years, some of the resources and training and areas that I found the best is I joined the IAFCI, International Association of Financial Crimes Investigators, when I started in fraud. And they gave me a book, and it was a directory of every other person in the IAFCI. It had law enforcement in there, it had other banks, other technology companies. It was like this white pages of fraud people. And the IAFCI not only gave me that book, but they would do conferences, and I started to go to conferences and learn a lot about fraud. So that was a really good resource. The NICB, which is the National Insurance Crime Bureau, an investigative group, they do the same thing. They have conferences. Their conferences are amazing. So I learned a lot from them. The ACFE conference, the best conferences are the annual ACFE conferences, where the material is top-notch of just fraud material. I learned so much from those. The conferences are a great way to go for a day, 2 days, 3 days, and just get saturated with fraud content and anti-fraud strategies. So I think that's the resources that really helped me.
What do you wish you had known when you had started?
I really felt like I had to follow the procedures. Like, this is my job. I can't deviate from it. Just follow 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Do this every time. And it took me years to realize that you have to not follow the procedures always and look at it differently. Don't listen to what other people say. Trust your gut. If you're a fraud fighter, you got to trust your gut, right? Because you probably have a good intuition. It took me many years to discover that I had ideas that could break the mold, that could do things different in fraud that were valuable. I wish I'd known that earlier, because I probably could have tried to accomplish even more.
It's interesting to say that, because I would totally agree. I spent 20 years in government. And why we do it this year? Because we did it last year. Well, you know, things have changed. Technology has changed. Right. The schemes have changed. Well, you can't do it that way. We did it last year. It worked. Well, it's not going to start working, you know, the next 5 years. You get on the front end of this stuff, you know? Things have changed.
Yeah,
and then all of a sudden, absolutely, with law enforcement, they'll be like, I'll give you an example. there was this big thing in the Hollywood shootout back in, well, about 20-something years ago, where people used rifles in order to rob a bank. No one ever did that. And then all of a sudden, they were having shootouts with cops, and cops had pistols, and they had rifles, and they were getting – it was just horrible. And now, all of a sudden, it's oh, yeah, we need to start having rifles now in our cars. Well, you know, we could have told you that years ago, but it took something like that to happen in order for law enforcement to change their mind about having rifles in their vehicles just because, hey, listen, they're being outgunned, literally.
Yeah, you're right. Fraud changes in an instant, and crime, same thing, right? It's all about skirting the system, whatever that system is. You have to be dynamic. That really good point there, Robert. I totally agree. You got to be ready to change on a dime. Don't get too comfortable.
Yeah. When you get your bachelor's degree, you learn about the rules, and then you get your MBA, you realize, well, the rules don't always apply.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Some things work and some things don't.
Absolutely.
That's true. That's one thing I learned about when I get my master's degree. It's like, oh, all those rules I learned that, oh, yeah, there's 15 other ways of looking at this too. So,
yeah, exactly.
Looking back in your career, what was the biggest mistake or lost opportunity that you had?
You know, that's an interesting question because I look back at this one decision that me and my business partner made in 2005. And we started that mortgage company. We got a call from a tiny 3 or 4 person company. Their name at the time and still is Zillow. They called us and said, hey, you guys are really good at modeling. Can you create us an automated valuation model for home values? And we can't pay you because we're a startup. And we were like, well, we are too. We need money and we're going to pass on the opportunity. That was in 2005. That model that they asked us to create is now known as the Z-estimate, which is the de facto standard AVM used by almost every consumer in the United States to value their home. And we wrongly passed on opportunity because we weren't going to make money in that at that time. To me, that was my biggest regret because it's kind of like, don't always go for the money. Sometimes you have to take a risk. We didn't, and it was a wrong decision.
Wow. That's a cool story, Frank.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is. It would have been better if it was the other way around when we took it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. With your training and going from one bank and one unit to another and starting your own business, there's got to be people that have helped you along the way. Aside from your parents, who had the greatest influence in your life?
Yeah, this is pretty simple. For me, that's my brother. My brother's about 3 years older, named Bill McKenna. You know, all growing up, we shared a room. I just watched him my whole life. And even when I was young, when he turned 16, he ended up getting a job and working 6 hours a day. Right after high school, he would go out and go to his job working in a grocery store. And he'd ride his bike. It was like 15 miles away. And he'd ride back and forth and do this job. And then he went on to go to college. And after college, he went on to just accomplish a lot of things like being a black belt. He ran the Western States 100. Which is a 100-mile endurance race in the middle of summer in the wilderness. He's a helicopter pilot, a plane pilot. And really, he's always been that person that has driven me because I look at him and say, look at how he's pushing himself. And he would always give me guidance. And so I really looked at him and what he accomplished and pushed myself to try to do the same in whatever I did.
Very good. Very good. You ready for the final 4 questions?
I absolutely am.
What is your biggest motivation now?
My biggest motivation now is to work on scams. That's why I joined the Noble. It's the greatest frontier and fastest growing area of fraud is scams against consumers. It's also 100% about helping people and making a difference regardless of the financial benefits. To me, it's making real change, right? It's not about the bottom line, but making real change to potentially millions and millions of victims and consumers that are being scammed today and losing their life savings. I want to really help solve that problem.
I've had a couple of guests on my podcast, just like yourself, and we talk about the impact that financial scams have on people, whether it's on the Ponzi scheme or whether your identity got stolen or, you know, just pick the scam, right? And how it is worse or can be worse than getting beat up in the parking lot somewhere, because the lasting effects can be forever, where people have to go back to work because all their life saving is gone, where they thought they'd have a comfortable retirement at 60 and now they got to work till they're 80. And it's easier to recover from, you know, a broken nose or a broken hand or something like that nature. But man, when your life savings is gone and you now got to work for the rest of your life, even under circumstances that may medically make it difficult, that those types of scams just have a huge lasting effect. I don't think the courts see it sometimes as much as they should, because we all want to live in a safe society, but the implications of the effects of a scam can be just devastating for maybe a decade or more easily.
Oh yeah. About 50% of consumers don't even report it. They live in silent agony over being scammed. And yeah, a lot of consumers will not report because they're ashamed, because they're felt stupid. They felt dumb. They should have known better. They know it now. It never gets reported. So that those people that are actually making it in the court, you know, in these cases, represent only the tip of the iceberg. There are millions of people out there that have been scammed that live in shame and despair because of it. So you're right. It's a extremely trying psychological impact that goes well beyond the finances. That's why it's so important.
What book or books have changed your life and thinking?
I read a book called Manias, Panics, and Crashes, A History of Financial Crises. I think it was, it's kind of a classic book. And it's really about the history of market booms and crashes. You know, it goes all the way back to the tulip mania of the 17th century, when they were exporting tulips and tulip prices shot up, you know, to hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, just some ridiculous price. But then it crashed. And it goes all throughout history showing this psychology of market manias, panics, and crashes. That book taught me that history repeats itself. It really was applicable in fraud, because I see this all the time where, you know, we talked about mortgage, right? And that whole mortgage fraud crisis was because the mortgage market was absolutely booming. And because nobody wanted to think about fraud, but then it crashed. And you know what? It's happening again. We're seeing the mortgage market go crazy. You know, are we in for another one? We don't know. But anytime you're in a peak when the market's booming, you know there's a ton of fraud happening. And so that really kind of changed my thinking. I'm like, every time that we're in good times, I'm on high alert because I know the fraud is out there and it's probably occurring much more than it ever did before. So that really kind of changed my view on fraud and how I personally look at it.
Yeah, there's a reason why they call it liar loans back in the day.
Yes, they certainly were. Yeah, we had a whole podcast on liar loans. Some of the things I saw.
I had a case where a guy was on tape. He called it a liar loan. It's well documented out there in the world if people want to Google all about it. But I had a world-renowned athlete that on tape stated he did a liar loan and ultimately caused the banks to lose some money. So interesting. With the trial on it and everything, it was pretty interesting. Had an undercover agent do the investigation for me, or start the initial, you know, contact with them. And yeah, he called a liar loan on tape. So it was kind of
okay.
Oh, well, is all I could say. Oh my goodness.
Oh, okay. I'm going to read that one. I think I see it here. Okay.
All right. Yes. All right. Share something that you've purchased in the last 12 months, less than $100 now, that you enjoyed or made your job easier.
This might be a little more than 100. I think it's $140. But anyway, it really changed my life over the last year. I did about 18 different virtual conferences last year. And so I do know these are pre-recorded Zoom calls, right, where you record and you talk about fraud. And I bought a teleprompter that fit over my camera on my computer. And it allowed me to kind of write my messages and kind of scroll through them as I was presenting my slides. So I didn't have to kind of come up with everything on the fly. And that teleprompter has just made my life infinitely easier, because before I do a presentation, I just kind of write my notes. When I'm reading the teleprompter, I'm looking right into the camera. It looks like I'm talking to the people on the other side. So it helps me connect more. So that teleprompter was a huge help this year because of COVID, when everything went online.
So what is the brand and where'd you buy it at?
Teleprompter Pro, I think it's. It's online. If you just go teleprompter for iMac, you'll see a few different versions of it there. I actually don't have the exact brand, but there's like
It's okay. So yeah. It's teleprompter for iMac. I guess if you Google it or put it in Amazon, it'll pop up.
If you need to do a lot of presentations, or let's say you're not the type of person that likes to think of things right off the top of your head, you want to read your note, you know, you want to read it in a natural way, get that teleprompter. You're going to look right at the camera and you're going to be able to just speak. And it's going to look really natural.
Frank, if you got fired today If you had to do something else, what would you be doing?
Oh, well, you know, and you came from this background, but I've always dreamed about working for the FBI. Even when I was in San Francisco, and they were starting, this is back in 1995, they were starting the first ever FBI cybersecurity unit in San Francisco. And I applied for that job. I didn't get it. But throughout my whole career, I'm like, wow, that would be kind of a dream job for me. If I ever got an opportunity to work with the FBI, I'd probably do it. And I'd probably do it for free because I just really admire the level of investigative, the quality. That would probably be something I would love to do. It would probably never happen, but I would do it in a second.
I understand. I actually, back in my early years, I was late 20s, I applied to the FBI. I always wanted to be an FBI agent, special agent.
Oh, yeah.
Since I was a teenager, I always wanted to be one. And I got an accounting degree because I hired out accountants. And then I got out in college and did my CPA world. And I was applying for FBI, Secret Service, DEA, IRS. And the IRS picked me up and the FBI said no. So I got shut down by the FBI after the interview process. And I was like, you know, I'm just bummed because, you know, whatever. So fine. But I got with the IRS and the IRS has nothing but their special agents are accountants and have a business background, accounting background for reasons because of tax fraud and money laundering. Mm-hmm. And it was a good career choice. Don't get me wrong. And I find it ironic that about 2 years into my IRS CI career, 9/11 happened. So, and then the FBI switched gears into let's follow the money, let's trace down every terrorist because terrorists are financing and da 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 da. And by golly, if they didn't ask me, hey, can we have you sit in our office and sit there in a joint terrorism task force and help us trace money? And I was scratching my head going, wait a minute, it's not their fault. Just 3 years ago, you told me I wasn't good enough to even go to school with you guys. Now you're begging me to sit here in the desk beside of you and help you work these financial transactions. Interesting. And, you know, the FBI agent, he just laughs. He was like, you know, I didn't do the hiring. I was like, I understand. But, dude, it was just kind of interesting going, yeah, right.
they're very picky. I guess we share that in common too, right? Getting rejected by the FBI, but
yet being asked to can you help me out please? Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah. Why not? Yeah, last year, 2 years ago, you didn't care.
Exactly. I know, it still stings, huh?
it stings a little bit, but it's still funny when I had an investigation where the FBI was working on something, and I love the FBI and the run-of-the-mill special agents, you know, doing the work. I've had a good relationship with almost all of them except for one. So, you know, one out of 20 is not that bad. So 19 out of 20 is good. So I've had very good relationships with them. And because we are the accounting finance nerds, we would always do the money aspect of things. And we were the experts on the money stuff. And many times the federal prosecutors would want us to join because we had the tax angle and the money laundering. Mm-hmm. We were the follow the money experts. And so we get to work quite a bit with them. But it was just interesting going, and you guys didn't pick me. Yeah, I know. So
timing is everything, right?
It really is. It really is. And there's a purpose under the heavens for everything. I know it. At the end of my career as a special agent, the right choice was made. IRS was, I think, more family friendly and we didn't have to move as much and no complaints. I tried to do one thing and God had something else different for me and planned, which is even better. So
Exactly.
It was great. Well, Frank, I thank you so much for what you are doing for society and what you have done. And thank you so much for dedicating your time to help a nonprofit organization to help people not become victims of scams. And I do appreciate your time on the podcast. Good luck to you and at Point Predictive. Thank you so much for being there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate you giving me a voice here to tell my story for all that you do as well. And, you know, this podcast and highlighting people and, you know, trends and things like that. It's just so valuable. So thank you as well. And I just absolutely loved our conversation and I do appreciate it, Robert.
Well, thank you.